Welcome to the second in the Five Hindrance series, given this Thursday nights. This will be on ill will and aversion. The hindrances are basically obstacles to calmness of mind. They interfere with concentration and interfere with the meditative absorptions. And ultimately, they're hindrances to our freedom. They're sensual desire, ill will and aversion, restlessness, sloth and torpor, and skeptical doubt. The suspension of the five hindrances leads to joyfulness, tranquility, and happiness. We talk about the hindrances primarily in the context of meditation practice, but really we want to work with them outside of practice as well, since most of us spend most of our time not sitting and meditating. So if we practice working with them and noticing them during daily life, it will help us in our sitting and it will also help us in our daily life. They're universal. Everybody has them. And it's important to recognize and acknowledge them so you can work with them. I find it interesting that in Pali, the word for hindrances is nivarana. So it'd be the five nivarana. And to me, it's like a phonetic anagram of nirvana. So it kind of implies that the suspension of the five nivarana will get you a little closer to nirvana. So ill will is basically an unfriendly or hostile disposition. By the way, the ill will is the what I understand is the technical definitions, but in the West we've kind of added aversion, so really both. So the ill will part's the hostile disposition. The aversion is just feeling a dislike or turning away from something. So they're related, but one's a little more hostile. And really it's like the opposite of mindfulness, because you're turning your attention away from, whereas mindfulness you're turning towards. And basically you're wanting something to be different than it is. You're pushing something away. And, you know, it can range from a very mild resistance all the way to intense rage. But the same mechanism is at work. We're resisting something or pushing it away. It can be from a mild irritation, such as an itch, or it's a little too warm, or somebody came in late and made too much noise. It can be righteous indignation, or it can be disgust, anger, hatred, rage, and fear. So in meditation, we make the effort to keep our attention on the meditation object, usually our breath, and this becomes our reference point. So if we are drawn away by feelings of aversion, hopefully it'll be more noticeable because we have this reference point. But if you do go off and you notice it, you want to have a friendly attitude towards noticing it. You can kind of celebrate that you noticed it. It's not that you failed to notice the breath, but you now noticed something else. So it is a little victory of sorts, because you're bringing mindfulness to bear. If you're having a negative feeling about having the aversion, then you're adding yet another layer. So you don't want to do that. If you insist on seeing it as a failure, then you can think of what Churchill had to say. Success is the ability to go from failure to failure with no loss of enthusiasm. It's not always so obvious that a hindrance is present. Sometimes we have such a persistent way of viewing the world or viewing ourselves, and you can have a self-talk that can be very negative, or self-judging, or judging others, or judging everything. It's kind of like you're swimming in it like a fish in water and not, you don't see it. And this was brought to my attention once on retreat when during Q&A, somebody asked about what they could do about all this self-judgment they were feeling towards himself during sittings. At that moment, it dawned on me that I had been doing that a lot, and it never occurred to me once. And so it was good. I call that kind of like mindfulness by proxy. So it's helpful to listen to other people's questions and see if they ring true for you. I just thought I hadn't been meditating very well, wasn't concentrating very well. But it turned out I was doing okay. So it can be useful to try to notice your habit patterns of mind and the way you speak to yourself, the way you comment, sub-vocalize on things around you. Are we putting ourselves down or others in some way? Sometimes this is where relationships can be helpful, where someone can reflect back to you and perhaps point out blind spots. So we can see how we're behaving that we might not have noticed. My wife has helped me in this respect, pointing out patterns of hostility that I either could not see or was unwilling to acknowledge at first. And now I can do it in return. So we've advanced. So we help each other in that way. And actually put it to an end pretty quickly, usually, because we want to make the effort to be kind to each other, so we'll get off it pretty quickly. So how do you work with aversion when it arises, either in normal life or sitting? Basically, you recognize it. You have to recognize that it's happening. And then you have to accept that it's happening. And then we investigate it and then not identify with it. The acronym for that is RAIN. So you have to recognize that the aversion has arisen. You cultivate a friendly attitude about it, appreciating that you've been mindful enough to notice it, even if it's been running for half an hour. The friendly attitude allows a genuine acceptance and allows us to accept that this is what's up for us right now. So we don't pretend that we like what's happening, but we have that friendly attitude, and we value the awareness of that noticing that mind state. Then we investigate it to get to know it a little better. And basically, we see how it feels in our body. Are we contracting anywhere? How is our breathing? Is it changing? Is it changing over time? And if you can see that it's changing, then, of course, you realize it has the quality of impermanence. And lastly, non-identification. You see that it's not really who you are. It's something passing through you. You don't have to take possession of it as yours. And we don't have to identify with it as who we are. Terence Gray, who goes by Wei Wu Wei, or did, he says, "Why are you unhappy? Because 99.9% of everything you do is for yourself. And there isn't one." Another factor to consider with emotions is that there is a mental component and a physical component. Anger and fear in particular can place you in an agitated state for quite a while after it has stopped and after you stop thinking about the incident. For instance, a near car crash, you might... And your heart can be racing for another 10 miles after the near miss. So it can be confusing sometimes because you may feel the physical reaction still roiling in you, but really it's not in your mind in particular. And it's a normal phenomenon. It shouldn't be cause for more self-judgment. It's part of the flight or fight response. And it's an effective, physiological process because the tiger still might be chasing you, and it wouldn't work if you just, got excited for a moment. So at these times, you can breathe deeply through the tension and just try and let it flow out of you. Deep breathing. Once you've calmed down and you can look at the situation from a more relaxed and wider perspective, you can assess the best course of action or non-action to take. And using your imagination and wisdom to best address the situation, keeping in mind non-harming, kindness, and goodwill. One time, after doing some yard cleanup, I put my pruning loppers and pruning shears on top of the clippings in the toter, and the next morning it was time to take out the recycling, and I closed the lid and rolled it out. And then I realized that I just gave them away. I went immediately into the self-judgment of how stupid. How could I do something so stupid? And, I gave away these expensive tools. But I quickly realized it was unskillful and sprung into action. So I breathed deep. I calmed myself. And I investigated my body's sensations. And then I thought about how nice it will be that someone will find these good tools and make their day. And someone else will use them. And essentially I came to a place of sympathetic joy, which is one of the sublime abodes called mudita. So that would be an example of applying skillful means in daily life when you do something stupid. Ill will is a very appropriate term to describe the attitude that in reality has the ability to make us ill. Because ill will, anger, hatred, are damaging not only to those we express them to, but even more so to ourselves. In intense anger, your heart rate can go over 180 beats a minute, and your blood pressure can go over 200. And essentially the fight or flight response has kicked in. And so a whole flood of hormones are released. And one of them is a coagulating hormone. In case you get bitten by the tiger, you want your blood to stop. So most of the time when we get angry in our culture, there's no tigers. We're just sitting around, standing around. So it's even more harmful because we're not kind of releasing it by running. And you can get a heart attack or a stroke. So it's another good reason to calm down if you get angry. I was reading they actually have studies that, verify that fact. So the Buddha said holding on to anger is like holding on to a hot coal, grasping a hot coal, picking it up and throwing it at somebody. Essentially, you're the one that gets burned. We don't want to repress the anger, nor do we want to act it out. Both are harmful. If we're highly concentrated, the hindrances become suspended, not present in our consciousness. But if anger should arise from some thought train or in a life situation, we then look at it and explore it in our bodies and stay present for the experience. Often the object of our upset is misplaced. Someone you're meeting for an appointment doesn't show up. Did they forget what time you were meeting? Did they just forget about you completely? You could get angry about it, but it's better not to assume ill intent. It's easier on our hearts and minds to forgive and let go. If you're not yet able to forgive or let go, It's enough to incline the mind in that direction that you want to forgive. Then you can begin to soften your heart. At one retreat, there was signs posted about there being a water shortage and to use water sparingly. So perhaps people weren't showering as often. And a friend told me when he was sitting on that retreat, once he was meditating and the smell of stinky feet was really bugging him. And he couldn't believe people would be that inconsiderate. They could at least wash their feet and use water sparingly. But by the end of the sitting, he realized they were his feet. And so the object of the anger was misplaced. And it often is. But the visual of that event for me on my retreat helped me a lot, gave me a lot of smiles thinking about that. When anger or ill will arises, there's usually an initial feeling of threat or hurt or fear involved. But the anger quickly rushes in and takes over, so we rarely notice, or we might not notice, the hurt. Often people are primed, too, from earlier psychic wounds in life. So the bypass of the hurt or fear may be very brief before it reflexively becomes anger. And the anger, of course, feels empowering at first. But with the rush of adrenaline, the fear or hurt would make us feel vulnerable. So we're much more inclined to want to feel the anger. But really, once we're in touch with the fear or hurt behind the anger, we can begin to deal with the roots of what's underlying the hostile feelings. Sometimes we're dealing with aversion that arises from another's anger towards us. And it's helpful to realize that they have an underlying fear or hurt that's running them. And what that can do really is hopefully make you feel more compassionate towards them. But it may still be a situation that you want to extricate yourself from anyways. But it's not required that we take possession of the anger of someone else. It's their anger. And that alone can be quite liberating. The Buddha said, "Hatred never ceases through hatred. Hatred ceases by love alone." Indulging anger by replaying the event or thinking about it increases the anger and gets you angrier. The presence of mindfulness can put a brake on the vicious cycle. One of the aspects of working with anger is that it blocks concentration and weakens the ability to make wise judgments. Sometimes it's hard not to feel that the anger is justified. So you have to have a strong sense that you want to abandon it. Sometimes it's best to walk away. Acted out anger causes damage to yourself and others, and it has detrimental effect in the body. Some of the other qualities that are cultivated to counterbalance the aversion, ill will, anger, or fear are loving kindness, compassion, and equanimity. These are called the Brahma Viharas, or sublime abodes, or sublime attitudes. So there are phrases that one can repeat for each of these that can be done as a formal practice. Often a teacher will recommend that someone do metta practice or loving kindness practice, repeating the phrases with the intention of connecting with the heartfelt wish. There are some traditional phrases which can be modified to suit your sensibilities. You start by doing the phrases for yourself. The phrases I use are, may I be peaceful, may I be happy, may I be filled with loving kindness, and may I be free. Some people say, may I be healthy and strong, may I be safe. When I was doing them one day, a melody came in, And I found myself singing the phrases. And I still do that now. Sometimes I chant them or I'll sing it internally. And what I realized that the melody did was that it was more heart-opening. Because often people have difficulty doing metta practice. They just don't feel it, and so it feels kind of mechanical. So you might think about that as an option if a melody comes to you. I shared my melody with some people, and they kind of go silent. So it's probably not everybody's melody. But I did look it up on the net because I was curious about it. And I don't know how they found this out, but if it's true. But supposedly it's the most well-known country song in the world. So keep you guessing. And if you want to know, I'll tell you after. You have aversion to being in suspense? Okay. So say you listen to or read a news item that really upsets you and you start feeling a little bit angry or fearful. You can do loving kindness phrases for yourself. Or with a compassionate wish, you can wish that the people involved be free of suffering. And then you can lastly remind yourself that this is the nature of the realm we live in and bring equanimity to the situation as well. There is violence and injustice in this world, and we are doing our part to uproot the causes within ourselves by doing these practices. Likely for most of us, it's a long-term project. Righteous indignation is another expression of aversion that is quite common. It has the air of a justified reaction to something that's going on in the world that you think isn't as it should be. And politics is one area that's ripe for indignation. There's so much that goes on that one can be upset about. It's very indignant to be, it's very easy to be indignant about some policy that is seemingly so wrong. But is it helpful or useful to do this? We want to look to see our attachment to our view and the suffering it may cause us. With righteous indignation, it's okay to feel you're right, but the indignant part, it makes us suffer. It's like taking it personally or feeling like a victim of the circumstance. So we want to try and nurture equanimity over indignation. So fear is another aspect of aversion that comes up. And it's a pushing away of something that hasn't happened yet. And even if it is something imagined, even if likely, it will probably never happen just as you imagine it. I think of fear as an acronym for future expectations appearing real. And again, being in the body is the most important part of working with fear. If you have the luxury of time to deal with the fear, as you might during formal meditation practice, you can learn a great deal about it. In some situations, the best thing you can do is counterbalance when you're off the cushion. If you are shy and awkward at a party, you could focus on engaging people who seem shy themselves and make them feel welcome. Don't focus on your own fear. Get out of yourself. If you're hiking and there's a scary path and you have no choice, narrow your focus to the bottom of your feet and channel your breath there, channel your full awareness there, and don't look over the edge of the cliff. If you run into an animal you are afraid of, you can do loving kindness practice and also study the habits of the predators you might encounter where you plan to go hiking. So you know whether to start running, play dead, appear extra large, or start thinking about your next life. So when aversion arises, recognize it, accept it, investigate it, and don't identify with it. Switch the focus from the object of your aversion to your subjective experience. How does it feel in your body? What are the feelings there? What are the sensations and emotions? Sometimes if the feelings are too strong or too difficult to work with directly, other methods or remedies might be more useful. You can increase your focus on the breath by counting breaths. You can play with the breath a bit by taking some deep breaths. You can also broaden your focus to sounds. If we're dealing with a pain that arises in sitting practice, we want to try and stay in the present. If, say, a knee or back pain arises and pulls our attention away from the breath, then that becomes our meditation object. Investigate the process of the pain and see that it is a process, not a fixed solid thing. Rather than thinking about it, experience the sensations in your body. Experience them closely and see if they change. And then soften any resistance to them. Try and bring kindness and tenderness of heart towards it. Eventually, you can broaden your field of awareness to look for any pleasure that's also occurring in the moment, no matter how subtle. Let the pain just be one of the things you're noticing in your field of awareness. In daily life, if someone in your life who habitually irritates you, you may want to change your focus. Try and pay attention to their positive qualities instead of what annoys you. If you're disliking a situation, you can pay attention to what you might learn from it. If anger is a big issue, the regular practice of loving kindness can be very helpful. If you have self-aversion, you can reflect on your own deeds and what you've done that is skillful, ways that you've helped people. If an emotion is very strong, other strategies may be appropriate. Some long, deep breathing, going for a long walk or jog, or talking to someone who you trust who's a good listener. One time on a retreat, I had a roommate who was challenging for me at times. He would come in late at night and turn on the lights. One time I came in the room and he was going through some of my things. Another time, my normally dry toothbrush in the morning was wet. I didn't see him use it, but I could only wonder. He had some unusual habits. And then my anger really peaked when one day I came into the room and it reeked this horrible smell I never smelled in my life. I had no idea what it was, but I was pretty sure it was that he was responsible because it was in our room. So, I'd been several days on retreat, several weeks, I think, at this point, and I was pretty calm and relaxed, pretty spacious. So I was able to notice very quickly myself, the anger rising slowly, and was like, wow, I'm getting angry. I'm not supposed to get angry on retreat like this. The interesting thing about it was I could notice all the process and still there was this me watching the anger. And that made it very manageable. But then I started to think about how could I extricate myself from this situation. I had several more weeks to spend with him. And then at that moment it dawned on me that I would not feel the way I felt towards him if he was my son, if he was my mentally challenged son. And that just changed my feeling towards him completely. I was able to really do that and go there. I did actually ask him, I asked him not to do whatever smell he made again. He agreed. So, it worked out fine. But it's an example of, you can apply the practice and reframe a situation and then ask for what you need if it's appropriate. So hopefully that some of this is useful in dealing with the more difficult mind states that arise in sitting in life. I think one of the beautiful things about meditation is that by doing it, we are in effect saying that we're worthy of attention and that just being is enough, more than enough. Another aspect of dealing with ill will involves forgiveness. And it has been said that forgiveness is giving up all hope of a better past. It is letting go of the past. It doesn't erase what happened, but it does allow us to lessen and perhaps even eliminate the pain of the past. And then the pain of the past no longer dictates how we live in the present. We become more than victims of the past. It's no longer wanting to hurt those who hurt us. I think one of the amazing examples of this level of commitment to this practice is recounted by the Dalai Lama in the story of Lupon La, who was a Tibetan monk imprisoned by the Chinese forces when they invaded the country in 1950. He was sent to a communist camp and he was tortured and forced to denounce his religion. And the Dalai Lama asked him about, you know, his time there, and what was his greatest difficulty. And he said during his imprisonment, Lupon La said that he had only one fear, that he might lose compassion for his jailers. So most of us don't have that level probably of ability to let go that easily, but it's definitely something to aspire to. In the Bhagavad Gita, it says, if you want to see the heroic, look at those who can love in return for hatred. If you want to see the brave, look for those who can forgive. One of the things that became clear for me on retreat in a deep way was that all the past hurts I had felt from others were not personal. And in a sense, there was nothing to forgive anymore. For me, once I could see it that way, in a sense, it was just, there was nothing personal about it. So it was easy to forgive. To heal, we must eventually release any ill will we feel to ourselves or others. Meditation practice gives us one more, gives one more spaciousness to allow feelings to be observed in a non-reactive way. So even though you may be in the midst of anger or aversion, there is a part of you observing this reaction. It becomes a choice point to hopefully see more clearly what might be an appropriate course of action or non-action in a particular case. I sometimes think of this spacious observing quality of mindfulness as the witness protection program. Munindraji said, if you sit and know that you are sitting, the whole Dharma will be revealed. So all the practices and techniques are just skillful means to free us from clinging. There are techniques and practices and antidotes, but so many techniques and options might be a bit much in the beginning, or even in the middle, or the end. So you can always come back to your body and the breath. Our life begins and ends with the breath. Two people panting usually starts it off. So let the breath be your inspiration until your expiration. My last... That one? I said the last sentence was, so let your breath be an inspiration until your expiration. Did you want the one before that? So, I kind of expired on expiration. So if you have any questions, you can float them out there and see if anything arises. Any aversions? And in all three of our versions, that's great. Yes. Right, RAIN. The acronym RAIN, uh-huh. Non-identification. Originally it was not self, but that's sometimes problematic talking about not self, but non-identification. It could be RAID, don't identify. I think a version in that instance, I've only heard it as, it's also, greed, hatred, and delusion. Yeah, those are the big three defilements. Essentially, the hindrances are aspects of those three. So they're definitely related. So if you eliminate them completely in the hindrance form, you've taken care of the other three. So. Yes. You can use it anytime you're sitting and you go off your breath. You go off your breath and into, a heightened state of emotionality, or any strong aversive feeling, like pain. You can use it for pain. You can use it, for strong feelings that come up. Basically, it's just it kind of enumerates what happens. I mean, it ends up creating spaciousness around whatever it is. And so you're more able to deal with it.
Using it also in a situation where someone is, where aversion arises, overall anger, fear, whatever, the possibility to be able to step back a little bit, because my instinct response is to go off and move on harder, build some spaciousness before response.
Yeah, I find that the more I meditate, the more spaciousness I have outside of meditation. Retreat can really bring that to more to the fore, seeing that. When you're caught in regular daily life, it's like every moment is filled with something. And that's really what we seem to need most is rest and give our minds a rest. And so, really you're quieting, physiologically you're quieting parts of your brain when you meditate. And so it is sort of almost a literal spaciousness that you're creating in your brain. the old adage of, count to 10. There's a reason that even exists. So, that's one thing you can do is just, if you find yourself angry, breathe deep and count to 10 or 100 if you need to. But, because it doesn't feel good. It just doesn't really feel good. I think it's a little confusing, like I mentioned, it can be confusing because there is an initial rush. It's invigorating to get angry. There's that term rageaholics, and I don't know, I guess maybe that there are folks that do that, because there is a bit of a rush, and there's a feeling of power, and control, you can get control, people you do control the situation, but you also, of course, end up pushing people away because very few people want to be someone who's angry all the time. But yeah, I think that's how, you know, bullies in, you know, in school come into being, and you know, their anger works for them. So yeah, count to 10 or 100. Any more verses? Yes. Oh, what's that? Go ahead. Oh. There you go. Oh, it's probably needs a battery.
Use the other one. This concentration and meditation is such a comfortable state and calm that sometimes it's just so, I'm going through this experience that I don't want to get out of that concentration and get on with my daily life. And it's just, I feel like I'm called to meditate most of the time. And I'm a little bit confused about this state of mind, this state that I'm feeling all the time. I just like to, I don't know, maybe to becoming a monk or, but the reality is always in my face that it's not doable. I'm just wondering what the experiences of other people and how it shows up that they go through complete silence for a long time.
The last part, how they go.
How do you make yourself to go to a long silence and like monks do?
Mm-hmm. How do you make yourself go to a retreat?
No. I mean, I'm a little bit confused about this state of being that I want to meditate all the time.
You're confused.
And then
about what? About how to bring the relaxed state to
and live my life in Silicon Valley.
I see. I mean, I'm not clear exactly what you're confused about, other than how you're confused about how to bring that state to your daily life, or how to get out of your daily life.
Okay. It's easy for me to not to get angry. I mean, it's becoming really easy.
Uh-huh.
Even if someone attacks me, I can, you know, brush it off. But it's not real. It's real life, daily life, work,
mm-hmm.
house, relationships. It's, I just want to leave everything and go somewhere and meditate all the time. Yeah. And that has brought me some confusion.
Uh-huh.
I was just wondering if that's
I think that happens to a lot of people. And some people do something about it. But, you know, if you can't, if you're in a situation you have responsibilities, family to take care of, you know, unless you're rich like the Buddha and can leave everything to the nanny and go off. then, you know, you have to meditate as much as you can in your daily life, since it gives you a lot of joy. And just bring as much of that with you off the cushion. It sounds like you're doing great. So maybe you just have to postpone this, you know, desire to be a nun someday or a monk, and, you know, but keep practicing, you know. And, you know, your practice will be a gift to everyone around you. You won't get angry when they get angry, like you said. And so it sounds like you're doing fine. You're getting attached to the calmness of mind. So, but you can bring that spaciousness with you, you know, so. Good luck. So I know the original,
What was your acronym for FEAR?
Future expectations appearing real.
Okay. Just with meditation, I've come to the realization how much my actions are based out of fear, and how much my decisions are based out of fear, and how much it never really happens the way I think it will happen.
Mm-hmm.
I still act out of fear a lot, but it's good to know that, or see that, and I don't know, work towards not acting out of fear.
Yeah. Or you can even just act right through it. You just do it, right? One of my first retreats, I was sitting, I just became aware of this sensation in my abdomen, and I don't know what's going on. I don't know what that is. And I just kept exploring and exploring it. And then it was like, oh my God, that's fear. And then I realized the feeling was I was carrying this fear with me all the time. But it's usually suppressed, you know. But it's a common thing, I think. Because we all know what we have to look forward to, right? Things usually end badly. In sickness and death. And, you know, the Buddha reminds us to, you know, I was reading that he said that meditation on death is supreme. But for some reason, we don't do that one too much around here. We postpone that one. But so fear is a big one. Future expectations. So yeah, it seems like you know, it comes back to that present moment thing. Don't look back, don't look ahead. You know, especially if you're on a tightrope. Even if you're falling through space. It probably feels pretty good. It's just you can relax into it. Anyway. So I believe the clock is broken because it looks like it's been 10:02 for 10 minutes, but I think it's my imagination. Time is frozen still in my mind. The old format, we'd actually meditate at the end. And that would be a pretty radical thing to do, to just go back to that old style. And let's just meditate for 8 minutes and see if we can create a little more spaciousness.